Hello, and welcome to the Natural Selection Presents Altered States. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Natural Selection. We're here with you today in limited number. We've just got two of the three of us today, but I think we'll try to make up for our lack of one, Nick. Still got one. So I'm Nick, and we have Naomi.
Hello.
And that's it today. So we're going to get going. Naomi, will you tell us a little bit about who we are?
Yeah. So for anyone who's just joining us for the first time today, we are The Natural Selection. So each episode, we discuss the news and recent research in the first section. And in the second part, we talk about a different theme. So this week's theme is altered states, and we'll talk about some plants and animals and different things that and how they fit under that theme.
Normally, at this part of our episode, the host of the episode asks if we've had any interesting encounters with the natural world. And I'll ask also, but I've got a good one this week, actually, from today. Naomi, do you have anything exciting from the last week or so that you've seen or done in nature?
You know, not really, actually. Very, very limited nature interactions this week. I'm trying to think if I even had any. No, I haven't had any. I'm intrigued by your exciting one, though.
Well, okay, I've got two. And one of them's not so exciting, but it's like I bring this up a lot, so I'm bringing it up again. But I saw a bird, which not just any bird and not just anywhere, but I see these birds like flying in the sky sometimes. That sounds so, I know, like, what am I even saying? But I am not in Berlin right now, but I'm in the countryside. And every morning I look out my window just as the sun is coming up over the horizon. And I see these enormous herons flying, like swooping through the field that I can see from my window. And they look like nothing more or less than pterodactyls. They're like so big and so hooked, like they're just so like pointy and pterodactyly. I just am like, there are dinosaurs right there. I know pterodactyls aren't dinosaurs, but still, it's close enough. But today I saw a horse, and it was a beautiful, beautiful horse. And it like came up to me as I came up to the fence, and we just like looked at each other in the eyes, and I held out my hand, and it put out its nose, and it touched me with its soft lips, and I looked at it, and it looked at me, and then we walked away.
Cute. That's much better than my interactions. I love it. Also, yeah, herons are really interesting flying. I also similar with like pelicans and stuff. Like you definitely see that like prehistoric. You can definitely see the relatedness to dinosaurs.
Yeah. Cool. It's like it's a good reminder, and it's also like cool to see something so big so close to home.
Yes. Yeah. And I think as well, herons is something I suppose I always associate with like water and kind of. I'd often see them fishing rather than flying, so it's kind of fun when you get to see them like in a different sort of state.
Yeah, and when they're standing on like the riverbank or something, they look like they're like hunting monks. They're like so still and like stealthy, but like hooded and like hunched. I don't know. They're cool in that mode, but then flying, it's like whoa, they can do that too.
Yeah, I know. I was so shocked the first time that I found out that they nest like really high up in trees. I always assumed, like I just assumed they'd like nest on like a riverbank because they're like large birds and also, you know, they hunt in the river, but no, they don't do that.
I don't know about where they are in London, but in Berlin, if you ever are dying to see a heron nest, the place to go is the zoo in the center of the city. Like all of the trees in the zoo, the park where the zoo is, the Zoologischer Garten, they're like, every treetop has a heron nest in it. It's crazy.
Oh, cool. Next time I'm in Berlin, I'll check it out.
Just come for the heron nests. So should we get on with the news?
Yeah, sounds good.
I'll start us off this week. I found something pretty boring, so we'll get it out of the way. But actually, maybe it's not so boring as it at first seems. A study that came out this week, it's a team of researchers based in China, the U.S., and one in France, and I don't know how the one in France got in there, but the rest of the group is spread between China and the US, and it's published in Nature. And it's something that is, it's a study on mice, and in like many studies on mice, it's not a perfect model for human biology, but it's a good way of sort of seeing how things might happen in humans. And this one I wanted to read you first the title of this because it's like so absurd. Corticosterone inhibits GAS6 to govern hair follicle stem cell quiescence. And I read that and was like, what? And
yeah,
read it
I
again.
Understood like two of those words.
I know. I read it like 3 times. And I was like, what are they telling me? Something about hair. That's all I could really get out of that. And stem cells. But then I read a little bit further and I got to the part that says, it's much more clarifying. Corticosterone acts on the dermal papillae to suppress the expression of GAS6, the gene that encodes the secreted factor growth arrest specific 6. Oh, of course. Maybe I should read a little bit more further to get a little bit more clarity, because I don't think I've really, I didn't quite grasp it yet. Okay. Our work identifies corticosterone as the systemic inhibitor of HFSC activity through its effect on the niche, and demonstrates that the removal of such inhibition drives HFSCs into frequent regeneration cycles. Oh, got it. Okay. No, I didn't get it at all. I had to read the abstract like 7 times. But what it turns out is that they're looking at stress hormones in mice and basically the effect that stressors have on the expression of these hormones and what then the hormones, effect is on different growth patterns in mice cells. And what they found is that when mice are under stress, their hair grows less.
Cool.
Right. It's like so clear when you say it in non-science speak. But of course, the mechanisms are what's important here for this study and the people who are reading it. But I thought that was really interesting. That, like, we hear about and joke about like losing your hair falling out when you're like super stressed or everything's going crazy, pulling your hair out. But there's actually a biological underpinning to that.
Yeah.
It seems that stress hormones inhibit hair growth.
Wow, this is really interesting. I wonder what the benefit of that is. Is it some sort of like stopping resources going to growing something? Or is it just like a weird sort of side effect?
Want to say that I have an answer for you, but I don't know. That's a good question. We could probably do a hypothesis and then a new study. That's my news this week. And like I said, not thrilling, but at least we got through some dense language there.
Yeah, good perseverance. I think, I might have read it and been like, no, I don't. I think I find something else.
Well, the only other thing that stood out to me this week was something about Neanderthals and human ancestry. And I was like, I can't do another one of these. The wildlife podcast.
The research that I found this week was looking at octopus. So it was published in iScience and it was produced by researchers from Brazil. So it was looking at sleep, and it's well studied in many amniotes, but it's kind of a difficult thing to study in invertebrates, particularly marine invertebrates, because they're in a marine environment, so it can be hard to do sleep studies. But they have shown previous observations suggest that there is active sleep in cephalopods. So they've shown the likely presence of sleep in the common octopus and in the common cuttlefish. But there were some gaps in those studies. So in this research wanted to kind of fill those gaps and work out whether it actually is sleep or if it's just sort of a resting period. So what they did to investigate this, they video recorded 4 adult specimens of the octopus in Solaris and looked at their distinct states and how they transitioned between these states. They suggested, their hypothesis was that the species had 2 different states where they were unresponsive to stimulus. One was the quiet sleep and the second was the active sleep. So they videoed the octopus and then gave them stimuli in these states to test whether they reacted to the stimulus or not. So they did find there was 2 distinct states. And in the active state, they found that the octopus actually changed color and their skin texture and their eyes moved. They could see the eye movement behind the closed lids. So the study showed that these quiescent states shown by the octopus in Solaris fits the behavioral criteria for sleep. This result suggests that they have this sleep cycle that's analogous to amniotes. So it's somewhat like REM sleep in people, but because they sleep for such a short amount of time, it's probably a little bit closer to the sleep of reptiles and birds. So in other mollusks, that they've shown to have 1 single state, but in cephalopods, it's suggested that this is like a convergent evolution with, say, amniotes. And it's interesting because REM for people is filled with dreams. So one of the researchers in an article I read mentioned that it's tempting to kind of think about what these octopus dreams might be and, you know, speculate about what they're experiencing. But unfortunately, at this point, we don't know, you know, particularly when they're showing all these vibrant flashing colors and they're changing their skin texture. It can be fun to think that maybe they're dreaming, but I think more work will need to know whether they actually are dreaming in the same way that we might. And even if they do dream, we may never actually understand it.
Whoa. Cool. I have never before today thought about whether and what octopuses dream about.
Yeah.
Octopi. That's cool.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating as well. I think it's really interesting that they do this sort of color change in their sleep. Is it like they're practicing? Is it just that it's a response to like the stimulus in their brains? Or yeah, it's a cool study. So it definitely brings up other questions, I think, but
Yeah. Well, now it's one step there as well. We know that it's happening and we have a bit more understanding about how it happens.
And I think something interesting they mentioned as well, because these cephalopods have like slightly more of a like complex sleep cycle than other mollusks, it's kind of interesting that it maybe matches with intelligence as well. That, you know, the animals that we would think have more intelligent mollusks are ones that maybe have more of a complex sleep cycle. So
cool. Well, that's our news for the week. That's only two pieces, but you'll have to make do until next week, listeners. So we'll take a short break and come back after our break.
Hello, welcome back. This week, we're going to talk about altered states. So I think I came up with this one, and I apologize. It's probably a bit of a curveball, but hopefully there's enough of a room to discuss something.
I like this one a lot. I think immediately my mind went to like intoxication, which we will talk about. But then I thought, well, what else can we go to? Like, what's an altered state that we have access to that doesn't have to do with toxins or some sort of like, substances? And I thought of meditation, and that is the sort of altered state of, I hate to say this, but like a master meditator. What's their body doing? And is it something evolutionarily founded? And does it exist in other forms in the animal kingdom? To get there, I sort of have a two-parter here. So we'll go first deep into the brainwave patterns of meditation and then a bit into what those brainwave patterns might do in other animals besides humans. So in deep meditation, the brainwave pattern that comes out is called a theta wave rhythm. It can be measured using an electroencephalogram, which I had to practice saying because it's not an easy word, or an EEG. It's sort of an oscillation in brain electrical activity in a particular rhythm that can be observed. It's in the hippocampus and other brain structures in many mammal species, from rodents, rabbits, dogs, cats, bats, even marsupials, and humans. And I just should note that when we talk about these sort of studies that look at brain, anything, sort of anything biological, and I say that it's mostly seen in rodents, rabbits, dogs, cats, etc., that's because those are the most easily and most studied animals too. So keep that in mind, that it probably happens in a lot more animals than that. But those are the ones that are best studied. So that's the group that it's known in, and in humans. In rats, which is the most frequently studied group for this sort of brain activity, theta rhythms are easily observed, like I said, in the hippocampus and in other parts of the brain. And that frequency has a range of about 6 to 10 hertz. And usually appears actually when a rat is engaged in active motor behavior. So when they're walking around, or if they're like sniffing around. So walking around their cage or like doing exploratory sniffs. And it also occurs during REM sleep. A nice connect back to our talking about octopus dreams. So in humans, this hippocampal theta rhythm it's also been observed to be linked with memory formation and navigation. It sort of spikes when those two things are happening in the conscious, when the human is awake. Humans exhibit this wave activity during REM sleep. So it's this sort of weird, like it happens in times of specific active work with the mind, navigation, memory formation, and also during the sort of regenerative time of rapid eye movement sleep. And it can be brought about in the awakened human. Awakened is an interesting word there, but not for this conversation. That's a bit more philosophical. But it can be brought about in the human that is awake by doing meditation. So that shifts us from our sort of day by day going about doing normal things, alpha wavelength, into theta when we do meditation. That brings me sort of to the wrap up of, okay, what are theta waves and what they look like? But now the question I had was, what does it do? Like, what's the point of theta waves and what do we know about it? And that it seems like this is one of those frontiers again, one of the places where we don't have a lot of information, but many different researchers, neuroscientists and cognitive behavioral scientists trying to figure out what's going on, which is cool because then we get to talk on the podcast about these theories. And the one that I found sort of is the most prominent right now and seemed pretty convincing to me, but I'll work us through it, see how we feel, is that theta rhythm plays a role, a really important role in spatial navigation and episodic memory. And the way that they sort of track this is by looking at how navigation works in most animals. So mammals have this ability, many animals, but in particular the way mammals do it, is they have this ability to keep track of their location, even in dark, like total darkness. And it looks like the way that they do that is in a part of the brain called the entorhinal cortex. And during this sort of moving around in space, the entorhinal cortex has a specific type of neuron that fires. They're called grid cells, and they pulse at a specific time, and they keep track of how far the animal has moved or where the animal is in space when it fires. So it's like a check-in, like a little ping, like, where have I gone since the last time I pinged? I'm doing a terrible job, I'm sure. Talk to any neuroscientist at explaining this, but I'm not a neuroscientist, so bear with me.
No, I get it, I think.
Thank you, Naomi.
But that's my own understanding, my limited understanding of neuroscience, not how you're explaining it. You're doing a great job.
Great. I think that you might actually have more than I do, so that's good. So this pinging, it happens in a regular rhythm. It's periodic. And the theory is that it's sort of set off by the theta wave rhythm, because this is something that happens in the brain at a specific frequency. It happens like 6 to 10 hertz. So pretty regularly. And if that's happening, then it means that this location tracking is relative or related to the theta wave mode. So without those theta waves keeping track of the period, the animal wouldn't properly be able to calibrate where they are in space and how far they've moved since the last ping. Because if the pings weren't regular, then that tracking system wouldn't work right. So that's the theory. It's hard to test this sort of stuff. It's hard to tell if an octopus is dreaming, and it's hard to figure out what exactly this sort of electroactivity in the brain is doing. But it seems like it can be pretty important evolutionarily to be able to keep track of where you are in space, which is something that, you know, bacteria can't do, for example, but mammals are pretty good at.
Wow, that's pretty cool. Interesting as well that that's something that's like meditation, which is almost the exact opposite of that kind of finding yourself and that sort of, you know, moving and actively searching for yourself, is like so opposite of like sitting and emptying your mind. So it's really cool that that's like that triggers the same sort of response.
Well, you know, Naomi, some people meditate to find themselves.
Yes, good point.
No, but you're right. It comes back again to this REM. Like the theta wave appears both in times of memory formation and navigation and in the REM cycle. It's really interesting to me that those two things happen. Like, yeah. And then you can bring it about by doing some meditation, which is like, yeah, it's a very silent and still process.
Yeah. I wonder if it's like you're practicing, because isn't that one of the theories with like dreaming? Is that like you're going through processes in your brain to like cement the knowledge you had?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm not sure any of my dreams ever helped me in that way. But
yeah, no. I know. Sometimes I think I'm with you there.
That's pretty, really cool though. I like what you said when you kind of initially thought of like the idea of intoxication, and that's kind of where your mind went. So that is exactly where my mind went. So I wanted to talk a little bit about animals on drugs.
Great.
Yeah. Specifically, I wanted to talk about one experiment that you may have actually seen or like heard about is experiment where they gave spiders drugs and then they looked at the webs and the different effects that these drugs had on the webs. What's interesting about that experiment is why it started in the first place. So actually it came about in the 60s and Hans Peter actually wanted to document spiders building webs, but he didn't want to stay up until 2 a.m. when spiders build their webs. So he asked his pharmacologist friend if he could rig up a way to give spiders drugs so that they would be awake during the daytime.
Oh my God.
So his friend, Peter Witt, who I think was a pharmacologist and a zoologist, did this and, you know, gave the spiders various different drugs. But he was fascinated then by the results of the web building. And this completely didn't work for the first guy because the spiders built very weird and deformed webs depending on the kind of drug they had. So I think they were giving caffeine, LSD, marijuana, and I think there was a couple of other drugs in there as well. This is often used as a example of like how toxic these drugs are based on how deformed these webs are. So usually the spider's webs would be a spider web shape. I don't know if that's too... it would be kind of that spoke shape with the circles. But these webs were kind of, depending on the different drug, they're quite deformed. And interestingly, the one that was the most abnormal for what it should be like was caffeine. So a lot of people, I think, use this to kind of highlight, you know, how toxic these kinds of drugs are. But, you know, it's been realized since then that's not really showing us this because it's kind of difficult to make these extrapolations from how these drugs work on a spider's brain to what they might do to our mammal brain. But it is interesting in what they do to spiders. Funnily enough, because I mentioned the caffeine being one of the worst ones, it's because actually caffeine can be an insecticide. It can be lethal in higher doses for insects. So I imagine spiders, which are related, wouldn't be doing so well from the caffeine. So this kind of led me on a bit of a path of looking at other times scientists have given drugs to animals to kind of see what happened. So
is that the official reasoning? I mean, just to see what happened.
Yeah. Well, there is one, and I like honestly, I feel like this is why they did it. Like they have a reason, but it's just sketchy. It's a sketchy experiment. So again, this was done in the 60s, and so they gave LSD to an elephant because they were trying to look at must. And they wanted to try and trigger this sort of behavior because they wanted to study how they might control it. So they wanted to produce this sort of erratic behavior. So they thought, let's give the elephant LSD. And so they decided to give the elephant 30 times the amount of what would be lethal to a human. So the elephant didn't
Not
do great.
Not 30 times the amount that a human would take for a nice trip. 30 times the lethal amount.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
The elephant's name was Tusco, and he was an
Wait, this Naomi. This sounds like you're prepping me for some bad news.
Yeah. So he. Oh no! So they injected 30 times what a 3-ton human might receive.
Wait. They injected him with 30 times the amount that a 3-ton human would have received.
Yeah, that's what I'm seeing here. They gave him 297 milligrams.
This sounds like a horrible thing.
Yeah, so I'm reading here. After 5 minutes, he trumpeted, fell over, defecated, and began shuddering violently. So then they gave him, about 20 minutes later, in order to try and calm him, they gave him an antipsychotic. They injected him with it, which was probably not the right thing to do. Also, they didn't actually write down why they did it or how much they gave him of that. And then they also then gave him a tranquilizer, which is what they use to give the lethal injection, I believe. So yeah, he died.
And oh my God.
It was not a well thought out experiment. There's a lot of errors. Like they didn't make notes about why they gave those things. They didn't have a contingency. They gave way too high a dose. They didn't like test Ooh. It.
When was this done?
In the 60s.
Okay, but still. Oh my God.
82, I believe. I think people also then, because he was in a zoo, people were quite upset after this. And unfortunately for him, but thankfully for other animals, this really tightened up what scientists could then do and how they had to conduct experiments. So this really brought about a reform in, you know, research and researching animals. So I think it took a little while before a lot of these things fully worked, but, you know, it kind of hopefully stopped some of these things happening. But I have a couple of other examples in perhaps, I guess, more natural environments where animals might get high or drunk. They're kind of anecdotal evidence. And so some of them are a little bit controversial in terms of we're kind of maybe anthropomorphizing it and deciding that they want to get drunk as opposed to, you know, it might just be an accident. So one is elephants again. In South Africa, there's a legend that the elephants get drunk by eating the fruit of the marula tree and that they enjoy its intoxicating effects. But there's people have worked out that really in order for an elephant of that size to get drunk, they would have to eat a lot of fruit. So it may not be true, but it seems to cause this sort of frenzied behavior afterwards. But it might just be because it's a coveted prize. They get aggressive because they don't want to share their fruit with other people, with other elephants. Potentially as well, they eat the bark and there's larvae in the bark and they may also be intoxicating. Other ones suggest that dolphins with pufferfish, and they've been seen with like pufferfish, like hitting pufferfish with their snouts, which is kind of, this one's quite controversial because pufferfish do have a toxin, tetrodotoxin, but it's not a psychoactive. It just induces numbness. So it wouldn't like alter the mind, like say LSD, like we discussed, or alcohol. So it kind of be a weird choice for them to do this, but there have been kind of anecdotal cases where they've seen dolphins interact with pufferfish in this way. And another one I've seen is in Australia, where they grow a lot of poppies for medical purposes, that the wallabies go into the poppy fields and they get high and then they like spin around and they make like little crop circles, the poppies. Yeah.
Funny. I saw a video actually, and while I was doing research for this episode, of dolphins passing pufferfish around in a group. And like, yeah. Which is like really funny to like, to, I mean, regardless of what's happening after, like seeing them pass this like ball of a pufferfish around is like quite amusing. But yeah, we can't, I mean, we can anthropomorphize all day, but we don't know yet what is happening to those animals. I was reading also about caribou, the reindeer that eat psychoactive mushrooms, like fly agaric is a mushroom that they'll eat. And then sometimes they have this sort of like weird aberrant behavior where they leave the herd and do other things. But weirdly, or not weirdly, is that the urine of animals, the ones that have eaten the mushrooms, is then like fought over by the other caribou. And it's hard not to anthropomorphize, but humans, we don't have to anthropomorphize, but humans, indigenous people who live near these caribou, have been known to use the urine of the caribou because basically the psychoactive compounds are in the urine excreted, but the toxic elements have been taken out. So the things that cause the detrimental effects of the mushroom are like removed, and it's like an even stronger but less damaging high or trip that you get the urine of the caribou. So
interesting.
Who knows?
I wonder, those are the kind of things you wonder how, who the first person was like, I'll just try it, you know?
I guess that if you see other caribou, like, doing something weird around that, you're like, why do they want that?
Yeah, like, true.
Try.
After you've just seen a caribou, like, running amok and doing weird things.
Yeah, give me some of that. The things that I sort of thought of right away here, thinking about animals, on intoxicated animals, was close to home. And catnip came to mind. So I did a little research on catnip. And honestly, there could have been something a bit more thrilling here, but I didn't know how it worked. So that's what I found out, and that's what I'll tell you guys. So sure, those of you who have cats or have seen cats, when exposed to this plant, in German, the word is Katzenminze or catmint, which I like because it looks similar to a mint plant. cats will eat the flowers and they'll rub themselves on the leaves and on the stems. Or if you have it in a toy or something, it's just like the crushed up dried leaf, and even that can affect them. But usually they show like their signs of intoxication. They'll sniff and do weird rolling and licking and rubbing around and jumping. And some cats, based on behavior, it seems like social active cats by nature tend to get more social and more active and really affectionate. Whereas more, let's call them introverted cats, tend to withdraw and like sort of close in and not want to engage with other people. So it seems that some cats, this is also sort of controversial. We can't know what's going on in the cat's mind exactly, but it seems like sometimes they can also maybe hallucinate or have some sort of response to their environment that stimulates their startle response or their hunting response. So they'll like hunt stuff that isn't there or get really startled by things that aren't there. So who knows whether they're hallucinating or not, but they do seem to show all these other symptoms of intoxication. But the chemical, the psychoactive chemical in catnip is called nepetalactone. The lactones, there's a really huge class of compounds, organic compounds, but it's one that's found in a lot of plants and something we know from perfume. It's used, the lactones exist in a lot of different smells. So it's interesting that then it would be like something that comes through the nose, and cats, they don't have to eat it to get affected by it. They can just smell it. This is the sort of the hypothesis for why they respond the way they do, is that it sort of acts as an analog to pheromones, cat pheromones. So male cats will show decreased attention to prey, and female cats will start doing this rolling behavior. And these are things that you see when female cats are in estrus, the response of the males and the males and the females themselves. But interestingly, this is the sort of the like key that I didn't know. Catnip sensitivity is a genetic trait, and about a third of cats don't react. So I always thought when I was growing up that I had three cats growing up at different times, and one of them didn't have any, there was like no impact from catnip. And I thought that it seemed like something was broken. Like, well, what's the deal? The other cat seemed to like it a lot. What's wrong with you? And maybe it was just genetic.
Wow. I didn't realize. I thought it was just like all cats love it.
Yeah, I think it's kind of like how cilantro or coriander tastes like soap to some people.
Oh, that's yeah.
Why I'm imagining it in my head.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, it tastes like soap to me. Well, it tastes gross. I assume it's that it tastes like soapy. I don't really eat it, so I'm not like, yeah, soap. But
yeah, you're one of the cats who doesn't react to nepetalactone.
That's interesting as well about the pheromones. It kind of makes sense in a way. I was wondering.
But apparently not only domestic cats respond to and love catnip, but wild cats too. Like tigers, leopards, and lynxes have been shown to respond in a similar way to catnip. And this goes back to our original conversation, some wild cat species, like jaguars, eat ayahuasca, which is a psychoactive plant that has DMT in it. But I don't know if it affects them in the same way that it does.
Interesting. Yeah, I was going to ask, actually, if big cats were affected in the same way. It's funny how sometimes big cats are like big versions of domestic cats, and then it's the same and vice versa. Like sometimes you see a domestic cat, you're like, wow, you're just a tiny tiger.
Totally, totally. Yeah. My cat that I live with at home, I've set up my dresser and my chair in a way that she can now jump from one to get to the very high dresser. So she can like sit at the very top of the room, and like she does the lion thing where that she like leans her elbow over the edge and like looks out at everything. It's just so like a little lion in the prairie.
Everything the light touches is hers.
Exactly.
So I, again, went down kind of a psychoactive route for this topic. This is actually the most widely consumed psychoactive substance in the world. Do you have any guesses of what it might be?
The most widely used psychoactive substance in the world?
Consumed, yeah. Humans, I guess.
Alcohol is the one that comes to mind.
So it's actually caffeine.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It is a drug. Wait, it is a drug. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, it's a psychoactive substance. And so there's been actually lots of studies on kind of whether it's behavior altering or addictive in the same way that other things like maybe alcohol or nicotine are. And it it doesn't really quite have those. While it does alter the brain, the effects aren't really long term. And also it doesn't have that same sort of withdrawal that other things might have. I wanted to kind of look at like why plants have caffeine. I also then, as a second part, I want to talk a little about coffee and how that came about. So coffee, the plant, belongs to the Rubiaceae family, which is the fourth largest family of angiosperms, so flowering plants. In 2017, a phylogeny came out that was looking at the Coffea genus and different groups of this coffee plant. And they found that Africa or Asia is probably the most likely ancestral origin for this plant. And the high and consistent caffeine content is only found in species that are from the equatorial, humid environments of West and Central Africa. So this is probably an adaptive response to pest predation. And I'll get into how that works in a little bit. There's also been found that moderate caffeine production has evolved at least one other time in a relatively new lineage in Madagascar. And so this suggests that either the biosynthetic pathway for this synthesis was in place earlier in evolutionary history, or that there's convergent evolution within this genus. And because there is convergent evolution with how coffee plants produce caffeine and also how cocoa or tea produces caffeine. So why have caffeine? Well, it's actually used as an insecticide. In high doses, caffeine can be lethal for insects, but also a lot of insects have receptors for caffeine, so they'll tend to avoid plants that have caffeine. Although, of course, there are insects that have kind of evolved to stomach this, and they can be pests of coffee and different things that have caffeine. But another thing that caffeine does, when the leaves fall on the ground, it contaminates the soil with caffeine, and then it deters other saplings and things from growing in that soil, so it kind of reduces its own competition with the caffeine as well. A really fun thing I found as well is, so it's used as a pesticide, but also it's actually used as a reward as well. Some plants produce caffeine in their nectar, and in those flowers that have caffeinated nectar, this helps the insects remember the flowers better. So they did tests with honeybees where they fed sugar solutions containing caffeine, and this naturally occurs in the nectar of coffee and citrus flowers. And those bees were 3 times more likely to remember flower scent than those just feeding on sugar, which is really interesting. And actually, caffeine in humans is also linked with kind of improved memory.
The idea that that caffeine, the one compound, can be both a deterrent and a reward system is like, plants are brilliant. We don't give them enough credit for their mastermind manipulation of all things that move.
I know, it's really amazing. I think because that was something I actually wasn't aware of. I kind of, when I'd been looking up why caffeine existed, I really read was that it was an insecticide. But yeah, it's cool that it also offers this sort of benefit as well.
Yeah, and a nice tie back to the spiders. If only we knew that there was an insecticide back when he was giving them.
Yes, yeah.
Spiders. No wonder, yeah. I mean, still trying to make those webs. I mean, if they got anything done. Imagine if you got poisoned and you were like, okay, now build your house. Like, yeah, yeah. Mine looks crap too.
Yeah, exactly.
Or even if you said, here, you've been poisoned, make your dinner. Like, I, you know, throw together some, like, I don't know, some craft frozen dinner or something. Nothing good.
Yeah. And then I guess I want to talk a little bit about coffee and why coffee and how coffee started as a beverage. If you remember when I was talking at the very beginning about the origins of the plant, when we were talking about the high caffeinated plant, it kind of seems to be from West and Central Africa. And so this is kind of where they think the coffee as a drink originated. Now, I will say that, you know, it's the origin is unknown. It's kind of quite early on in history, so it's not particularly documented. And there's a lot of different legends about this. But one particular one that I'll talk about is Kaldi, a lonely goat herder in the 9th century Ethiopia, discovered the energizing and invigorating effects of coffee when he saw his goats getting excited after eating berries from a tree. So he took these to a local monastery and gave it to the abbot, and the abbot decided to dry and boil these berries and make a beverage. And there, coffee was created.
That seems like pretty quick, straightforward, like they knew what they were doing.
I know, right? Yeah, they're just like, let's roast these and then drink it.
Let's grind it. Should we grind it? Let's dry, roast, grind, then boil this. But not too long.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
We should probably also put cream in this.
Yeah, I know it's good. They were really on it. They knew what they were doing. But from here, the drink spread to the Arabian Peninsula, and so from the Middle East, coffee spread through the Balkans, Italy, and then the rest of Europe. So yeah, and by the 17th century, coffee had made its way throughout Europe and was becoming very popular across the continent. Tried to look up exactly kind of where it first came into Europe, but there was different. I found different things. But coffee also seemed to go hand in hand with kind of social revolution and like social ideas, because coffee houses kind of appeared as a place to socialize. I will say for men to socialize, but that's kind of beside the point. And kind of with this, it also brought the idea that coffee was maybe something bad, something against God or against religion. Parts of the Middle East, because it was people were socializing with it. The ruler at the time didn't want people to socialize because he didn't want people to discuss how he was ruling. So it kind of goes hand in hand with this idea of socialization, and that kind of people maybe wanted to stop this, like people talking and having like intelligent conversations and discussions. Also in Catholicism as well, it was considered to be kind of, the devil's drink. I think it was called the devil's cup. But I think that eventually sort of got overlooked because everyone was like, coffee's just tasty. And it became the kind of known morning beverage and replaced beer and wine. And people, felt like they were working better, which I don't know if it says so much about the effects of coffee or the fact that they're not drinking beer first thing in the morning. The last thing I will say is that the first coffee house that was established in the UK was opened in Oxford in 1650. And then I think like 2 years later, the first coffee house was opened in London.
Human relationship with coffee. Of course, there's the whole history of, colonialism and imperialism there too,
Skimmed over some of those
but.
things. So I think something I did read was that, yeah, it was brought to America and also parts of Indonesia by the Dutch. And then there was coffee plantations and things created by the Dutch in places like Java or in Indonesia. When it was introduced, I think it may have been brought by Turkish slaves into Malta originally. There also was trade routes as well, which probably did bring a coffee as well. But yeah, it's something that it is interesting. I suppose it's such a widely drunk beverage. I thought coffee was an interesting one.
Yeah, and yeah, it seems like it became a drink so quickly and like.
Yeah, I think there's also other people who have claimed to be the first people to have brewed it. But yeah, I suspect there's probably a lot of trial and error
Yeah.
of the first cup.
Definitely. Well, who decided to try, the type of the rare coffee that's been eaten by a civet, pooped out, and then those are the beans that you brew? Like, who decided to try that?
Yeah. I know, right? Yeah.
Back to the theme again. Civet is they have a gland that excretes a musk that's used in that was traditionally used in perfumes. So there's something there. That's
Ah.
I think that brings us to the end of our episode today. And because we don't have Nick, we didn't want to decide on an episode theme for next week. So we'll leave it up to mystery and time to tell.
Ooh, exciting.
Until then, it's goodbye from me.
Goodbye.
And brother Helmut, do you have any of that Frappuccino, that chocolate frack that you brought last week to the Abbot?